Okay, it's Monday morning, the 26th of April, 2021, and here we are, B'toche Yerushalayim. I know the news around us sounds quite bad across the world, going down south to Jerusalem, and it is a real problem. I just want to comment. I had a talk with a student yesterday after class, and he raised the issue of the demonstrations going on against the Arabs. And here's where I have to tell you my own feeling is that these demonstrations only worsen the situation. What we have to do is pressure our politicians that the police should do a job properly, and the chief of police shouldn't state publicly, "We can't be all over," as if to say, "Come and there'll be openings for you to come and attack and lower lane what they want to do." And our politicians have to get to work. Also, every rocket shot in from us is a slap in the face of the Jewish people. It shows Dam Yehudi Hefker, and it's a tragedy that years ago when the first rocket came in, we didn't wipe half of Gaza off the map. Any other country in the world would have done that. Could you imagine rockets coming in from Mexico to the United States? But when you start demonstrating and you take it into your own hands, we have pandemonium here. And that's where I differed with Meir Kahana. My heart breaks when I think Meir was offered a safe spot on the Gachal ticket and he turned it down. He could have gone on to become prime minister, but you have to work within the system. And he had that ability. He was charismatic. But okay, this is my own feelings. I trust I'm correct. It's open to discussion. Did I give the date? Yeah, I gave the date already. And let me just roll with some of the correspondence. Then I have quite a surprise for you on Pesach Sheni. I see the hand matzah being eaten, and I just told my wife 2 minutes ago on the phone, "Leave me a note, remind me to eat matzah."
Is everyone out?
Excuse me, excuse
Is
me.
everyone out?
No, I'm teaching now. I
I'm not too.
Can't eat matzah and teach at the same time. We can do miracles, but even the miracles are limited. I want to mention, I said in class that Rabbi Yehoshua Fishman, who succeeded Joe Kamenetsky as head of the Torah Mesorah, is not well, and his grandson, my daughter, is married to Harav Fishman's grandson. So it's the father-in-law of the grandson wrote to me that Lo Aleinu, he has Alzheimer's for a number of years already, and he's... It's very bad. Alzheimer's is a very degenerating disease, as we all know. He needs a refuah shleima, a special man. Regarding Jack Gold, who helped sponsor that movie, A World Apart, so David Keane wrote to me that he knew him, actually. He did not wear the lavush, was clean-shaven. I do remember him wearing a gato. He was a businessman. He owned, and I think his children now own, a chocolate company named Madeline Chocolates. And he describes him davening in Bell Harbor, where David Keane grew up. And he says another mitpalel in their minyan was Rabbi Rachman, who often spent the Shabbos there visiting his son on Bell Harbor. Then I mentioned that Rabbi Krause's wife came from a Hasidic background, and I received a note from a Talmud, a sub-Talmud, as I call them. I want to point out to the Rebbe that you said that his wife comes from a Hasidic stock. Rav Simcha himself comes from a Hasidic mishpacha as well. HaRav Mordechai Krause, that was Rav Simcha's brother, who was Rosh Yeshiva in Or Chaim, Danny Lander's institution, Rabbi Lander, brother of Rav Simcha, was a Hasidic persona in addition to his brisker style of learning. I remember davening with him in Ravik Shul in Borough Park, and I wanted to ask Charlie, he's sitting shiva now for his mother. Charlie knew Rabbi Krauss Sr. I thought he was more Hungarian German on that part of Hungary. But you could also be in that part of Hungary and be from Hasidic stock. I also want to mention one Talmud misunderstood me, and I want to make myself clear. It goes back to a shiur I gave weeks ago about the Var Hatzala bringing Rav Aaron Cutler to America and why they chose Rav Aaron. And this Talmud understood me to say that he was the only Rosh Yeshiva saved by the Var Hatzala. No, there were many saved. I don't want to we mentioned all their names already in the course of our Shayurim. But at that moment in time, they had one opening. And you can read, Effie Zurup's book also deals with it. And why did they choose Rav Aaron? And this I heard in Lakewood. He was a young man. He was not the most famous yet of the Rosh Yeshiva. But the feeling was he was in the prime of life. And as I can tell you, you grow older, your koichot become more limited. It's inevitable. You can be perfectly healthy, but old age is old age. And they felt Rav Aaron could be successful in saving as many people as possible. Regarding the comment I made that Yeshivat Har Etzion is a self-perpetuating body, I mentioned that Rav Amital started to bring up the issue of successes 10 years ago. Time flies. So Rav Grinstein, a product of that yeshiva, says it's 16 years ago. Rav Amital is now gone almost 10 years. And he and Rav Lichtenstein did not nominate their successors, but rather an objective committee of the administration plus graduates plus former staff of the yeshiva did. And Rav Grinstein goes on to describe how the process worked. But evidently, it's a classic example. But this takes us back of self-perpetuating bodies. This takes us back to a topic I've lectured on in great detail over the last 52 years, maybe even 62 years. Maybe even mentioned it in reads in the 60s to younger students. This is the difference between many of the Lithuanian yeshiva and few and far between yeshiva which were public trusts. In Chevron, in Panovich, in Tells, if you weren't related to the Rosh Yeshiva, you couldn't be a Rosh Yeshiva. And this has a pro and a con. The con is obvious. Once you don't have good people in the family, the yeshiva falls apart, and you don't have to go further than what happened to Tells in Cleveland, in the greater Cleveland area. It also, I don't have to go further than last week, the Chilul Hashem of the Chilul Hashem to the 50th power, what went on in Panovich. I would have stepped in, and I would take that movies that was shown all over the world, and these guys shooting the guns, the tear gas, I would have put them in the army right away. These guys know how to shoot. They're ready already to go right into infantry. We'd only have to put them into basic first. But you see, that's what happens in a yeshiva when you're fighting over who should be the Rosh Yeshiva, the grandson of the founder or the grandson-in-law. It's the greatness of why you, or Teira B'Dash for that matter, or Merkaz Harad for that matter, is that they're basically public trusts. And they choose their successors. And they will choose who is capable. It's not a question of being related. With all my yichus related to Rabbi Rebel, no one in the world knew that 50, 60 years ago. No one in the world cares today. No one even knows who Rabbi Rebel is. So no one would even, but it's not the yichus. That's why with Rabbi Lichtenstein, I can let you in on a secret. I always get upset when people say, oh, Rabbi Lichtenstein, he is the Rav's son-in-law. As if to say it's only because of the fact that he was the Rav's son-in-law that he became who he was. I smack their faces and say, Rabbi Lichtenstein was Rabbi himself, the babe. There was one of a kind. Later he became the Rav's son-in-law. But that has nothing to do with his Gatlet and Torah. He would have been Rabbi Aaron and on the yeshiva faculty with or without being the Rav's son-in-law. The fact that he fell in love with Tovah is beautiful, and the family they raised, Kanayin Hara. And it hurts me because, to me, Reb Aaron is alive, and here it's in this this room where I'm sitting is where I gave a shiur in front of Reb Aaron and the Kollel years ago already on Shabbos, and Reb Aaron hugged me, and after the shiur, I don't want to repeat what he said to me, but Ashreinu Shezachinu. But that's the difference between self-perpetuating and where it's family-owned, family-guided. In Chaim Berlin, there was tremendous machloket. Part of it was that the Futner felt it's his family, and there were board of trustees who felt, no, that it's an institution that began before Rav Futner will continue after him. So you're well aware of this. Another point I want to make, David Keen as well contacted Rabbi Lyman's son and told him what I said in class, and Rabbi Lyman's son, Rav Shneur Lyman, Rabbi Dr. Professor, said that, yes, it sounds very correct what I said. Well, I can only tell you what I heard. I wasn't in the room when they came to discuss with the Rav. I was a kid. But we kids lay on the floor outside Dr. Belton's conference room to catch whatever snippets of the conversation. And actually, this is what Reb Shneur Lyman says. Actually, Highline High School was co-ed for its secular studies in the afternoon. The school could not afford to run two separate secular programs for its high school. Religious studies were taught from 9 to noon in two adjacent but separate buildings. The boys were in one building, the girls in the other. Each had its own curriculum. The boys learned mostly Talmud, the girls learned mostly Tanakh. Now, it's also fascinating that, and this I didn't know, that at a certain point there was talk about Highline High School becoming a YU affiliate. And the key issue was whether a co-ed high school could become a YU affiliate and whether it should remain co-ed. So fascinating when Highline began, how they latched onto the Rav, latched onto YU. That was the world at that time. And of course, they never became part of YU, and ultimately, merger with merger, today it's part of Hafta. I also want to thank my dear student, Dr. Alan Blau, who sent me some correspondence of Joe Kamenetsky. Alan's father was part of the Chabura that my cousin Noah Daniel was part of, and Joe Kamenetsky, and they learned together when Reb Chaim Zimmerman was in Borough Park in the early part of the late 50s, early 60s. They were Talmidim of Reb Chaim Zimmerman. They gathered around him. It's history and a beautiful part of history. One correction I want to make is I said Joe Kamenetsky came in Aliyah, which is correct, and I thought he lived in Bayit Vagan, because in Bayit Vagan there was a whole group of former Torah Mesorah people who retired to Bayit Vagan. I met many of them over the years. As a matter of fact, I even met some of them in this very building. So I thought Joe Kamenetsky lived there, but we see from the correspondence that he lived in Sanhedrin Ruchevet and not in Bayit Vagan. So if that is true, I correct myself. And finally, I just want to say, Noah Shapiro sent me an article on Satmar, and the article on Satmar justified his understanding and my understanding, and I think I was right in my debate or my dialogue with Rabbi Shalom Gold. Rabbi Gold was very angry. He claimed that Satmar ruined the American yeshivat. In 48, 49, 50, 51, etc., no one was anti-Zionist. Didn't mean they were formal Zionists, but it's like Agudat Yisrael in Israel today. There was not the anti-Zionism. Today Agudat Yisrael sits in the government, takes money, etc., responsibility, part and parcel of the general Zionist world. And my feeling is that in Satmar, there are a lot of Satmar people who want to come out of the closet and become very pro-Israel, etc. And we have to reach out to them. And that article that just appeared, where did it appear, Noah? Where was it from? Was that Tablet magazine? Times of Israel. I don't even know. It's a different world. You're in a world where all your information is online. I'm in a world where all I get online are the results of the damn Yankees. Pardon me for my malediction, but boy, do they deserve it. Aaron Judge should
come recently,
yesterday again. And when the heck did Judge get a hit that you can talk about? God, they made him into the shofet of everyone, and Ribbono Shel Olam, he doesn't even know enough to be a two-bit lawyer.
Agreed.
Baruch Hashem, I told him to agree with me. So that article justifies my thinking. I have more to talk about it, but that'll be in my lectures on Satmar. I'm going to introduce you to material that you may not have seen that blows your mind. And we have to reach out. We have to set the example. And Noach, you have a responsibility, because you wear a Shtreimel Shabbos. You wear a Bekesha. You're a Satmar. You have big Satmar Yichus. You relate to the Satmar Zeda and etc. And you're a YU person. Nothing wrong with it. All right, we have our problems in YU. How we're going to solve this homosexual problem is right now, you know, they're working desperately with it. But you're dealing with a Western world where there are no ethics and no morals and just pure idol worship. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. You know what that means? We believe in God. We don't believe in ourselves. That's what it means. In every generation, b'chol dor v'dor, and the world today, there's no God. It's just you. You set the ethics, the morals, etc. And YU takes millions of dollars. There's no two ways about it. And they're caught up with that. It's not like I just wrote to someone in America that Rav Avadya had a tshuva. It's not just a tshuva. What happened was, to give you just a drop of background, because I have a lot I want to teach today, but a drop of background, Michalach had a fundraiser, a dear friend of mine, Rabbi Louis Applebaum. He was one of the Applebaum brothers, a well-known YU family out of the 30s into the 40s. And Louis was a fabulous fundraiser, and he got hold of people in a Reform temple. The temple was selling its assets, and he convinced them to give some heavy money to Michalach. So Rabbi Kufman turned to Rav Ovadia and asked him if you're allowed to accept the money. All right, this sugya is I don't have to go into detail now, but you all know when the Beit HaMikdash was dedicated, you prayed for the Goyim as well as the Jews. So are you allowed to accept the money? And what, if a Jew wants to give tzedakah, how can you spit in his face just because he's a Machalo Shabbos? So Rabbi Avadia wrote an interesting tshuva. I remember Rabbi Koopman gave it to me to edit. And I actually taught it in class, and I edited it. And there I learned, I couldn't get over it, whenever Rabbi Avadia quoted a Gemara, a Rambam, it was never a total proper quote. The verb would be for the adjective. The adjective before the verb. The noun. Then I realized he was writing everything ba'al peh. Could you imagine? He knew kol hashas and every Rambam ba'al peh. Right? He confused the noun with the verb. But unbelievable. And Rav Avadia paskened, as long as they don't tell you what to teach and interfere with your Weltanschauung, it's permitted to take the money. The problem with the government money is they insist you have to meet their standards, and their standards are the destruction of the dignity of the human race, in my humble opinion. And this is a real problem. So you have a test to do, Noah. Take it and run with it. All right, now let's come back here. Today's shiur is entirely dedicated to Rabbi, a private smicha. Don't be overly impressed with the rabbi. He never used it because he always felt bad, as I explained to you, that he never got a YU smicha. He had to support his father and mother's family, many children, and he married his children, And then he got involved with Rabbi Young and his work and Jewish Center and the West Side, the day school on the West Side. What's it called? Manhattan Day School, the MDS. And he never had time to really do a YU smicha. He did have a doctorate in education from Columbia University. Everyone called him Dr. Joe. He wrote the introduction. These last few weeks I introduced you to Daniel Zvi Kramer's doctorate. Doctorate done at Bernard Rebel Graduate School, a very nice doctorate on the day school movement. He wrote the introduction. And Joe Kamenetsky wrote the introduction. And I want to quote to you from his introduction. And the introduction is very powerful because it shows you what went on across America. You're talking now, Joe Kamenetsky comes in the 1940s. By the 50s, he's running it. He is Torah Umesora. What was going on across America? Across America, reform was unbelievably big. Conservative movement was moving quickly. Orthodox synagogue after Orthodox synagogue took down the Mechitza. There were the court cases I spoke about, Mount Clemens, elsewhere, but it basically was a losing battle. Marshall Sklar, a very famous sociologist, wrote a book about Judaism at that time. I believe his first name was Leon Glazer. That's his last name. You can check the first name. Glazer wrote a famous book about American Judaism from a sociological point of view. And everyone concluded there is absolutely no future for Torah as we know it in the United States. I mean, if you would go back 70 years and pull these people out and show them what we have today in the year 2022, they would think it's a fantasy. It cannot be. And that was the attitude. Now, here Mr. Mendelovich comes up with this idea, in every community where you have 5,000 Jews, you must have a day school. And how do you bring this about? And you see, here is the Hashgacha Pratit, that as assimilating or assimilatory the atmosphere was, and Jews are running away, and that dummy Rak Heffer has said it so many times, grew up in the Bronx, over 700,000 Jews, total assimilation. Chil Shabbos B'Parchesia, there was no concept of Shmirat Shabbat. But wherever you went, there was always a little miracle that would happen. One or two people. That's all it takes. And that miracle, suddenly, you have a Meshuggah whose whole life now becomes one goal, a day school. And it's so hard to explain. Every community had a different story. And this is Joe's, Rabbi Yosef Kamenetsky speaking. A day school in New Jersey, founded solely by a group of women in the local bond office. All right, I don't even know what community he's talking about. It could very well be Newark. But you see, Newark was a big center. You had an office for Israeli bonds. Women worked there. These women started talking, what do our kids know about Yiddishkeit? What will they feel? We need a day school. The arrival in a small city in western Florida of a day school enthusiast from Los Angeles. The city of western Florida, I don't even know what he's referring to. But someone moved in from LA and he was insistent there has to be a day school for his children. No, once you start the day school, you can look what happened with Maimonides in Boston. The Rav used to say time and again, the greatest schut in his life. You might think he would boast about raising Talmudim like Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Rav Heschel Shechter, Rav Mori Willig, boast about those Talmudim in that picture from 1960 that we spoke about yesterday. No, the greatest achievement of his life, Maimonides Day School. The unusual determination of a rabbi in one of the smallest cities of Connecticut to bring back the ring of Torah learning to the old Talmud Torah building. And again, you have one Meshuggah who remembers there was once a Talmud Torah here, the building exists, that maybe there was a Gemara here in that Talmud Torah. Bring it back. Talmud Torah you can't have today. It doesn't succeed. It doesn't work. But a day school, he brought it back. And once you start it, there's no telling what the results will be. The presence of but one family group in central Illinois and an inspiring rabbi gathering around him a coterie of women born of Jewish mothers who had convinced their Gentile husbands to join the faith. And I have to tell you, this I saw in Lubavitch a few years ago. I was a guest at a big retreat for the schools in Lubavitch, that programs you have to attend. I think it's a year or 2 years where you study with your rabbi. This is all arranged. There's all a syllabus, and it's online, and it's in person. And then you're eligible to come to this retreat. And this retreat was in Palm Springs, California, if I'm pronouncing it correct, where Herman Wouk lived. And the hotel, Eina Niyut B'Mokam Ashirut, and the catering, oh, what went on there. And hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, famous people speaking. And I'm sitting at this table, and at the table, around the table, are very elegant Jewish women. Many of them, their husbands were born Gentiles. It's an amazing thing. And somehow at a certain point in life, the women woke up to their Jewish heritage, and they had happy marriages that the men went along with them and converted and went along 100%. You have to understand, just like in the Jewish world today, there's no belief. In the Gentile world, there's no belief either. These men, I have family members who are halachically Jewish. They were raised Catholic. My brother is in touch with them. And they write to my brother, we have no religion. They're not Catholic. They're not Jews. They know that in our eyes they're Jewish. And they remain friendly with the family. And here he describes these women with their husbands who were born Gentiles, built the day school. There appears in my mind's eyes too the picture of a Rebbetzin in Massachusetts who baked challah every Shabbat and sold it to her friends so that she could purchase furniture for the day school. And this too, I've met people with such dedication to keep a shul going, to keep a yeshiva going. I can only tell you, in Yeshiva Salanta, and everyone is gone already who can remember this, but I used to meet fellas and they would remind me my mother fed them. What's that? My mother fed them. The yeshivat had to serve lunch. Well, they needed volunteers to give out the food. There was a cook in the kitchen, but from that point it was all volunteers, from the kitchen to the students, to the tables, to cleaning up. And my mother was one of the volunteers. And I remember some of the women so distinctly, like it was the biggest mitzvah in their life to be able to feed yeshiva kids in the Bronx in Yeshiva Salanta. And I can understand what he's writing about here. And the city in the desert country of the Southwest, which took its first principal, a young man whom I had met in the Slabatka Yeshiva in Bnei Brak, who had once taught in a southern day school in a city which drove me out of town on my first visit, and now is a thriving, beautiful Jewish community. And again, you see, it's beyond words. People, you come, you're crazy, you're off the wall. Who needs a yeshiva here? And somehow, a few years go by, Someone matures, starts searching, starts looking, and the end result is you have a day school, and through that day school, slowly but surely, the whole community is changed. I never forgot when the Rav once spoke about what happened in Boston. So the Rav said, when I came to Boston in 1932, I went to Davin and the shuls. I was the youngest person in the shul. There was no youth there whatsoever. The Rav, make the cheshbon, he was born in 1903. So in 1932, he was, 29, 30. He was the youngest person in the shul. And the Rav said this in the 1970s. He says, when I walk into shul today, it is flooded with youth, and I'm the oldest person in the shul. And this is the result of a little miracle when you get a day school started. And in the introduction, he's very powerful. It's a beautiful introduction, he says. I don't want you to misunderstand. It's not that I succeeded in every attempt to organize a day school. And he tells the story that he came to a certain community. Again, it's chaval that he doesn't mention the community, but I guess he's worried people will identify the person. By now, this introduction was written many, many years ago, and no one's going to identify anyone. But he comes to the certain community, and the rabbi of the shul is his classmate from yeshiva and yeshiva college. And he pleads with the rabbi, get involved and help organize a day school. And the rabbi was very busy going through the Yahrzeit book of the shul to acquaint himself, I'm quoting Dr. Joe, to acquaint himself with the community, with the people, with the Yahrzeits. You know, a good rabbi, someone has Yahrzeit, you have to call him on the Yahrzeit, you have to see him in shul, you have to send a reminder. And this guy tells Joe, he says, I'm too busy with the shul, I just arrived here, I can't get involved in building a day school. And Joe Kamenetsky says to him, Chaya, my friend, I am talking about the Book of the Living, and you are engrossed in the Book of the Dead. And that's a very powerful comment. And then he says, I want to tell you of another time where I failed, but this story of what happened became my clinching point. Whenever I came to a shul and there was a meeting and we were discussing organizing a day school, if I saw I wasn't making progress, this was the story I told, which Joe Kamenetsky calls the clincher. And what's the story? He's telling the story that he came to a small synagogue in the community. He was trying to get them sparked towards a day school. And finally, they let him speak between Mincha and Maariv. And I endeavored in my Americanized Yiddish to convince some old Jews to help me achieve my goal. But they were not moved and began to present various excuses. One Jew claimed the rabbi is too preoccupied with synagogue matters. Another said they had no extra funds. A third feared that no teacher would come from New York to the small town. After all these excuses, the old Malamed in town who taught in the Talmud Torah got up and delivered a passionate speech, which I shall repeat verbatim. Quote, 30 years ago we wanted to build a Talmud Torah in town. You, Jake, said the rabbi was too busy. You, Louis, claimed there were insufficient funds. We had to support the shul. You, Chuck, insisted we would not get a decent teacher to come here. I want to ask you, Jake, where is your son now? Louis, what happened to your two wonderful girls? And Chuck, what is with your two boys? After these challenging remarks, there followed what I would call a deafening silence, until one Jew said, "Let's go see the building Kamenetsky picked out as a possible site for the school." It's very sad. Very sad. But this is when people talk of pluralism, it gets me so angry. There's no pluralism, there's just being a Jew. Very sad. Anyway, he goes on and he describes that in this community, it didn't work out at that time, but later they built what became a magnificent day school. All right, that's the introduction to Daniel Kramer's doctoral dissertation. But now we come to another volume. And this is a volume penned by Dr. Joe himself, Memorable Encounters. Dr. Joseph Kamenetsky. The book was published by an ArtScroll subsidiary. So I just have to make one point. I heard this from Joe Kamenetsky himself. I may have really heard it in this building in the Beis Medrash. I think that's where we met. There was some event here. He had to censor himself. We're going to deal with some, you know, here you have a YU person who remained a YU person, and he's involved within an organization in the Rabbinic Advisory Board, which is more right and more right and more right to a certain degree. And in writing his memoirs, he censored himself. I have to tell you, when I wrote Washington, I also censored myself. I went with one rule, which later I was complimented on. I didn't write anything negative. Someone, a number of people said to me, "Rebbe, you wrote over 500 pages. In your whole life, no one was negative towards you, towards your ideal." I don't say I can tell you stories. But I always felt, if you're positive, the message is much stronger. And in those 540 pages, you will not find one negative comment. And I understand Joe Kamenetsky completely. That's what I believe I heard from him. My Talmud, Dr. Alan Blau, who I quoted in a half hour ago, 40 minutes ago, his father was very close. These families, my family, the Daniel family, and the Kamenetsky family, and the Blau family, and his father, Robert Blau, Bobby Blau, was a Talmud Muvhak of the Rav out of the early 40s, mid-40s. He was a big Talmud Chacham. He made a panasav out of insurance. He sold insurance, but he was a very big Talmud Chacham. And they were intimate friends. And my Talmud Alan Blau wrote to me that he feels it was not, in other words, he didn't talk about Joe Kamenetsky censoring himself, but Misora, the ArtScroll subsidiary that publishes their history volumes, that they censored the volume. It could be, could be. What did they censor? he alludes to it. What did they sense is very simple. When you're dealing with the Rabbinic Advisory Committee and they had to deal with a YU person, so at times they would bark at him, a doctor from Columbia and Yeshiva College, Zezon Firin de Malucha, they're running the show here. In other words, believe me, it might have been at times a hard pill for the Rosh Yeshiva to deal with. And we'll see when we come to it, you'll understand between the lines. But I just want to mention it because in Memorable Encounters, whatever you touch upon there, you have to see what's written. And you have to have an intelligent approach, what's between the lines. It's what I say about Washington, there's a Torah Shebichtav, and there's a Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, I want to deal with one basic question, and this particular question, in my humble opinion, has overtones for your world, for Yeshiva University of today, etc. And I want to raise a question in this very classroom. My Sheyurim, due to YUTorah.org, very popular in the worlds beyond Yeshiva College, Yeshiva University, Stern College, etc. I don't even know if anyone has said, no, there are a few over the years. I've met Stern College women who have listened to me faithfully. But the popularity, you take Lubavitch, Lakewood, Satmar, etc., near Yisrael, I mean, I can show you correspondence. Okay. How is Rakefet able to relate to these worlds? And here, I let you in on the secret. The time I spent in Lakewood was, in reality, I put the months together, I don't know, maybe it adds up to a year, more than a year. Not that much. But it was a very deep experience. And I knew Rabbi Aaron Cutler as well as a teenage could know the Rosh Yeshiva. I'm ashamed to tell you, I once told Rabbi Aaron off. I tried to make him into a religious Zionist. And he dealt with me. But I knew him intimately. And it adds a breath of feeling, a breath of emotion, a breath of understanding that goes way beyond the narrow confines of a kid who went to MTA, Shalavim, back to Yeshiva College, put him where you want afterwards, America, Israel, graduate school, Smicha. The experience is rather limited. What Lakewood did for me, it opened me up to a world beyond the yeshiva. And then I think there's a second advantage that I have that you don't have. And that was very simple. I've spoken about this many times. When you got to Amsterdam Avenue and opened the door of the yeshiva, you were in a different world. You walked into Europe. Everything was in Yiddish. Some of you understand, not some of you, anyone in my classes understands that Yiddish is a very native language to me. I was shocked when I was so ill with the corona those first 2 weeks. I was talking Yiddish. I mean, my parents were born in Harlem. Where do I come to talk Yiddish? But it became a very, very important, more than that. You come into the yeshiva, all right, you're all talking English. Your rabbeim are not that different from each other. Not that different. Am I right or wrong? They're frum, they're wonderful, they're good. This one is more Litvish, this one a little Hasidish. This one more stress on halacha. We had a different experience. My rebbeim, what are you talking? Mir, brisk, tells, the Hungarische, the Hungarian, slabotka. Oh. Let you in on a little secret. Underneath the public image, there was a little tension there. A little, you know, tells. Moderna. They were modern. What can they learn? Brisk. Brisk. I'm speaking Yiddish. I'm forgetting already my English. They need a little musa. Rotten. Ach, it's not learning. Sidkut. Reb Chaim and the Chafetz Chaim, the anecdotal story, we don't know if it ever happened. But the story is fabulous that they met, and Reb Chaim says to the Chafetz Chaim, for ayat Sidkis, tu has gedaf, yedafer in agresor lamden. You're such a tzaddik, you should be more of a lamden. And the Chafetz Chaim says, Reb Chaim, for your lamdis, you should be more of a tzaddik. You understand? I don't know if it happened or not, but you've heard the story. I'm not the first one to tell it to you. The story is all over the place. So I have to tell you, that worked to my advantage. Because, I mean, I can tell you stories, you won't even believe me, but take my word, I'm not making it up. One Rebbe tried to hire Rabbi Riskin, Steve Riskin, the boy wonder, to spy on another Rebbe what he's saying about him behind his back. It was unbelievable. And what went on, old Rav Volk is a shtickle bulk, lie, 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 lie. So I have to tell you, on one hand, it bothered me. On the other hand, it troubled me. Why? And I have lectures prepared. God should spare me. Yoma will testify in my office. There are thousands of sheets. This is Billy Guzma on the European Yeshiva. And I understand. But it was a terrific advantage. It broadened my understanding that there was many different approaches. There were differences. And this is all in Litta. Imagine later on I got involved with the Hasidic world and the German world. And I'm proud to tell you, I gave a lecture it was in a hotel in Israel, in a Chalamayid, Max Wald, these are all Yekes, they're gone. And Jacob Breuer, he brought Jacob Breuer to hear me. You know what happened at the end of the lecture? There were hundreds of people that can witness this. The old Yeke, the son of Joseph Breuer, the principal of Breuer's, ran over to me and hugged me, a yekka hug, and he said, you know what he said, I quoted, Reb Aaron, I'm buying a ticket for you to go to Washington Heights and give this lecture in Kehilat Adat Yeshur. And without batting an eyelash, I said to him, Rabbi Breuer, by the way, he insisted on being called Mr. Breuer. I don't even know if he had smicha, but Mr. Breuer. I said, Reb Yaakov, who will pay my life insurance? You never saw a yekka laugh more. You understand what I'm saying, Ellie? That lecture was on Rav Shimcha Ful Hirsch. Today, they threw out Rav Hirsch's great member, what the machlokes that went on there. They're Lakewood. They're not Hirsch anymore. All right, Rakevet has to make a living. He lectures on all this. Baruch Hashem. Why am I telling you this? Because you have to ask a very basic question. Here is Joe Kamenetsky. He's a why you person. He grew up, he went to Yeshiva College. He was in the first graduating class. I'm holding in front of me, he almost fainted this morning, what the Rebbe produced. Here, we put this up for auction, I'd probably get $1 million for it. This is the Elkanite, June 1932. The first class. Joe, what's up, Yoma?
Hi, Rebbe, a private security service.
Okay, that's why I have you. And Joe Kamenetsky's picture is here. He's a YU person. He hugged me and kissed me, my working Rabbi Revel, one of his rebbeim. How did he succeed? How did he get along? How is he able to manage to deal with Rabbi Aaron Kotler? To deal with Rabbi Yitzchak Kotner? To deal with Rabbi Elie Tzvei, a later period? To deal with Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, which was basically easy? To deal with Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, you'll see, we'll talk about Reb Yaakov, but not today. But how do you take this YU person And remember, Reb, remember I told you in last week, I think it was, I cited to you that Reb Moshe Rav Ezrachi couldn't believe his eyes. Dr. Joe walks in, and Reb Moshe stands up for him and says, this man built Torah in America. How did he get along with all these people? And here, I'll give you the key. There's Hashgacha Pratit. In America, at the time he was in Yeshiva College, there was the Alter son-in-law, Reb Yitzchak Sher, son-in-law of the Alter Reb Slabodka, Reb Natan Zvi Finkel. He was in America raising funds for Slabodka. He was in America for a full year. And he had an office, actually, on the east side, Slabodka Yeshiva office. Fundraising was essential. And Joe Kamenetsky got to know Reb Yitzchak Sher. So here, there was an influence on him that went way beyond the confines of Amsterdam Avenue and 186th Street. You with me, Moshe? Binyamin, it opened the world to him. And he describes it as a very moving part of his book, beginning on page 56. And he tells the story that in yeshiva, and you have to remember, yeshiva then was the only game in town. Many of the later right-wing leaders, they all were students in yeshivas, Reb Yitzchak Yochanan. That's what you had. One of the people who became very friendly with Joe Kamenetsky was Yehuda Davis of Baltimore. Yehuda Davis of Baltimore becomes a big machanech, big, and plays a big role in the more right-wing world. And Rabbi Yehuda Davis was not happy there wasn't enough ruach in the yeshiva. He wanted more. I don't know in your time, but in my time too, there were always students seeking more warmth, more varimkeit, more depth, something more just beyond shas, rashi, gefet, gemara, perish rashi, and tosfot. So they invited, a Rebbe came to teach Tanya. And somehow it didn't catch on. Then they had Mr. Yaakov Yosef Herman, who was the father of Reb Nachum David Herman. This is the man who later a book is written about him, All for the Boss. His daughter wrote a beautiful volume. And he came and gave lectures in philosophy, Musa, made a big impression upon the boys. He had a long white beard, and everyone else with a long white beard, that geret Yiddish. He spoke perfect native English. The boys loved him. And then, one day, Davis comes in, and to this small group, and I can compare it, we had club hour. We had club hour. I don't know what goes on today. I remember on Thursday, if my memory's correct, instead of ending yeshiva at 3, you ended at 2:30, and from 2:30 to 3:30, half an hour on yeshiva time, half an hour on college time, you had various clubs. One of the clubs was the Musa Club, Avad Musa. I was a member. Rabbi Rubin was a member. There were others. Shimi Ida was a member. Jerry Blau was a member. We had a very unique group. So, all right, there were other kids who had a club. I don't know, a French club. They had a club, a philosophy club. We wanted more. Suddenly, Davis comes in, and Davis brings the news that Rabbi Yitzchak Sher is here from Slabodka. He has to remain a while. He can't go back. He has to raise funds. It's probably be here close to a year. And he's willing to teach a group of boys who want to come to him and learn Musa from Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. Every Saturday night, a group of boys went down to Henry Street where he gave a Musa Shmuis. In other words, he brought Slabodka to America for those who couldn't go to Slabodka in Europe. I have to say, a lady wrote this about me. She died. The lady who died, Jan Yomo, married to, I have to think of his name, a Talmud Chacham, what a family. A book was written about her. You know the family. Again?
Reb Machlis' wife?
Machlis. And what was her first name?
Henny.
And what was her maiden name?
Lustig.
What?
Lustig,
correct. Thank you for bringing it all back to me. Henny Lustig. What a tzaddeket. Zichrona tzaddeket levracha. And her husband, too. Wonderful. He should live and be well. So I have to tell you, I came up with an idea. It wasn't entirely my idea. I shared the idea in 1978 with another. We came up with the idea, a big problem, boys and girls going out. If the boy or girl want to go in Aliyah, they want to date someone who's also wants to go in Aliyah. You don't want to fall in love with someone who's going to spit in your face if you mention you want to live in Israel. So we organized Chevrat Aliyah Toranit, CAT. Anyone ever hear this expression? You weren't born yet, 78. Chevrat Aliyah Toranit. And the summer of 78 and the summer of 80, I gave shurim in America. And everyone who came to the shir, your idea was you're interested in Aliyah. And that's where I met Henny. She was my student. And Henny said about me, I brought Israel to New York. Her parents wouldn't let her go and study here for a year. People were hesitant to send girls away from the home. And this is exactly what Rabbi Sher did. He brought Slabodka to the Lower East Side. And Dr. Joe says, every Saturday night, a group of us went down to Henry Street to listen to his shmuas. And the members of our Chabura read today like a who's who in the Torah world. Reb Nassim Wachtfogel. Who is Reb Nassim Wachtfogel? No? Mashkiach of Lakewood. And Reb Nassim Wachtfogel, I write about him. Let me just think, where do I write about this? I write about this in Washington. That he used to regale me with stories. When Dr. Belkin came to America from Canada, where he had come from Europe, where his aunt lived or his sister, he had someone there who received him when he came to the Western world. Then he came, he had to find a place, a future. So he came to the yeshiva, this has to be 28, 29, and they learned b'chavruta. And Reb Nassim Wachtfogel told me he taught Reb Shmuel Belkin English, and Reb Shmuel Belkin taught him Gemara. And he, part of this Chabura, Reb Avigdor Miller, I don't have to tell you, Young Israel of Rugby, the tapes, the books, what a shame, Dava. Reb Mordechai Gifter, new Reb Mordechai Gifter, Rosh Yeshiva, later of Tells. Rabbi Nachum Dresen, who I knew very well, was my neighbor in Berlin 18 when the building opened in 69. Rabbi of Baltimore, Talmud of the Mechita, Talmud of Rabbi Revel, and on. And he got to know Reb Yitzchak Sher. Reb Yitzchak Sher, let me tell you a little bit about him. The little information we have, because these great people didn't leave much or didn't write much about their lives. But Reb Yitzchak Sher, his years 1875 to 1952, he married the youngest daughter of the Alter of Slabodka. Rav Yitzchak Sheikh himself, this is what's written about him. He learned in Kelm, he learned in Slabodka. The Alter appointed him to the position of a Rosh Yeshiva in the yeshiva. He was loved by his students in Slabodka. What was very unique about him, that he was a Gaon Adir in learning and a tremendous Baal Musa. And this was the Alter's idea, to show that being great in Musa doesn't detract from your learning. And later, when we published his Musa talks, they were called She'urei Musa, not Sichat Musa. His Musa talks were like She'urim. And his daughter later marries Rav Shulman, who's the one that establishes and builds the tremendous Slabodka Yeshiva in the state of Israel. So you see who this Yitzchak Sheh was, the son-in-law of the Alter, the father-in-law of Rav Mordechai Shulman. This was pure Slabodka, pure Europe, pure Vadimkeit of Musa, Yiddish, a different world. And his influence on Dr. Joe is crucially, crucially important. Now, on page 58, Dr. Joe says something which has great significance for yours truly. Of course, it was a fascinating experience. The Shmuasin were learned and inspiring, and we gained a great deal from them. After the Shmuasin, we'd all go down to Sohn's Delicatessen on Broom Street and get two Frankfurters for 7 cents. Can anyone tell me, Simcha, why this is so important to me?
Inflation, yeah.
Forget that. I have more money today than I had then. Sohn's, my wife's family, her mother's first cousin. And you should know, out of this family, they came to America in the 1870s. My wife has great-great-grandparents buried in Queens on Main Street in Mount Hebron Cemetery. Interestingly enough, my wife and I, all our 8 grandparents are buried in the same cemetery. And the Sohn family, what came out of it, it's Sohn, and Sohn marries into the family, and Brill, it's my wife's mother's maiden name. If I add it up, and you know, I just became very wealthy, much more wealthy on Friday morning, a new great-granddaughter who is named by now. I don't know the name, but my wife told me she got an email from my grandson that they're naming the baby at the 8 o'clock communion that he goes to in Leshem. So by now I have a name. If I add it all up, there are hundreds of direct descendants living al admat HaKodesh, kulam shomrei Torah u'mitzvot, from this family, from this delicatessen. The Sohns, some of them were malachim. Remember my lectures on the malachim? Some of them were malachim. This is all the family. So I'm very proud that he talks about Sohn's delicatessen. There's a Sohn in Alon Shmut. That's my wife's cousin, among many others. But you know who I'm talking about? He's a shiputznik. He's run a big business of building and repairing buildings, etc. He's married to a student of mine. She's a second generation survivor. I mean, they already have many, many, many grandchildren. Can I inherit? Maybe they have great grandchildren by now. Okay, and he writes here, sometime later, Rabbi Gifter, Rabbi Mordechai Gifter, he's a great Rosh Yeshiva, they would joke with me that he only came to the Shmuasin to have the Vushalach. Vushalach is hot dogs afterwards. And And this was Reb Yitzchak Sher. What an influence. Now, here, let me go further. What he talks about, very fascinating. There's someone listening to the Sheyurim, but it's someone I know 60, 70 years already, Rabbi Yitzchak Rubin. So Yitz Rubin, when the Rav spoke, I don't know how well you know Rabbi Rubin, he could record the Rav word by word by word. And he has those notes in Tool today. Since I was an intense college student, I took notes in English at every shmuis. Yehuda Davis came up to my dorm room one night and saw me studying my notes. He was flabbergasted to see that I had written them all down. At that time, it was moving to see an American boy so affected by the words of Reb Yitzchak Sher that he had recorded them all. He arranged a private audience for me with the Rosh Yeshiva. I read my notes in English. No, did the Rosh Yeshiva know English that well? What do you think, Noach? No. Davis translated into Yiddish for the Rosh Yeshiva. Every once in a while, the Rosh Yeshiva interrupted me and said, "Nein, nicht der richtige der Herr." All right, that's a word. Rabbi Rubin, do you remember the word der Herr? We used to hear it from the Mashgiach time and again. That's a word copyrighted in Slobodka. How do I translate it? Not the right nuance. Not the right ring of the explanation. Der Herr. Okay. So I tried another word or phrase. This went on for some time. After a while, Reb Yitzchak smiled, stroked his beard, walked over to the window and said, and he quotes in English translation, "Imagine the Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka is here in America teaching an American young man how to write in English." All right, this is, you can see the influence, you can feel the influence. We had the pleasure of listening to Reb Yitzchak Shmuelson for a number of months. We all cherish these precious times. To this day I have the Shmuelson. More than once I have discussed with Reb Yitzchak son-in-law Reb Mordechai Shulman and some of the other members of the family the possibility of publishing them. And this was one tremendous influence. Let me just get the pages right. 3, 65, 4, 59 is what we're up to. Okay. Okay, then he talks about the influence of Rav Yitzchak Sher was so great on him. And here I give you a preview. It wasn't only Rav Yitzchak Sher. The American youth was exposed to many visiting Rosh Yeshiva, particularly in the 1930s. In the 1930s, the world shifted, meaning Europe was in deep depression. Europe never recovered from what happened in 1929, the famous Black Day when the market crashed and the whole world economy was affected. America started recovering by 33, 34. It was a much better America. The European yeshiva were totally dependent upon the American yeshiva for funding. And the greatest of the Rosh Yeshiva, there's almost no exception, one after another came to the United States. Reb Baron Cutler, Reb Elchanan Wasserman, Reb Baruch Be'er Leibovitch, Reb Shimon Shkup, Reb Yitzchak Sher, one after another. And when these students were exposed to the European Rosh Yeshiva, many of them reached the decision, I can't let them go back. I have to go back with them. I have to go to Europe. And a trend began where the brightest students from Yeshivas, it's called Chanan, from Chicago Hebrew Theological College, from Teira V'Das, one by one by one, two by two, off to Europe, off to Slabatka, off to Mir, off to Tells, off to Bris. It was a trend that who knows how great it would have become if not for Hitler, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro. So some of these very fellas like Davis, others who studied with Reb Yitzchak Sher, soon enough followed him back to Slabatka when he had a return. Reb Joe Kamenetsky was anxious, wanted to go to Europe, but the family situation didn't allow for it. He was partially supporting his parents, his siblings. And he says, I felt very bad. And finally, he came down to the east side. He learned that Reb Yitzchak was going back to Slabatka. And he cried his heart out to Reb Yitzchak, telling the Rosh Yeshiva, the Mashgiach, telling him how much he wanted to follow him back, but the family situation doesn't allow it. And Reb Yitzchak put his arms around him, and he said to me with the kindness of his heart, which so typified him, make your shtender in America a Slabatka. And that's a beautiful thought. When you learn, you can rise above the moment, you can rise above the place, you can rise above the time. We become eternal and we become worldwide. Amcha Yisrael, make your shtenda a Slabatka. Before I left, he embraced me and kissed me on the forehead. And then he turned to another rabbi who was present and said to him, quote, you may be quite surprised that I am so enraptured with American Bacha, but this is a young man who thinks. I have never quite forgotten that kiss, and I think it had a tremendous impact on my life. It set the stage for my future contacts with the Rashi Yeshiva in Torah U'Mesorah. No, Noach, Moshe, have I proved my point? How did this Reitz person, how did this Yeshiva College graduate, how did this total Yeshiva mentality, YU mentality, he was open to secular education. He was a Mizrachiite, Hapol Mizrachi, a religious Zionist. How did he get along with all these Rashi Yeshiva and all that happened in America following World War II? And the answer is his exposure to Reb Yitzchak Sher. And he writes that later when Reb Yitzchak Sher went to Bnei Brak together with the settler of Mordechai Shulman, Slabatka Yeshiva, he kept in touch with him for the rest of Reb Yitzchak's life. And that's part of the secret. There's another part to the secret. This begins on page 61. And that, of course, is the Rav. Now, you have to understand, Dr. Joe went to YU the 20s into the 30s. The Rav at that time was in Europe. When Reb Moshe Soloveitchik came into the yeshiva, his first year was December 1929, so we can say in 1930, Joe was not a Talmud of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. He was busy in college. He was not on the level to be in the top shir. But by 32, the Rebbe has come to America. The Rebbe gets involved with Chinuch in America, Maimonides, the mid-30s. And by the 1940s already, particularly after World War II, the Rebbe was a world persona. Everyone knew about him, everyone turned to him, everyone looked up to him. But you have to understand with the Rav, he too was more broad than just YU. He had relations with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, had relations with Rebbe Aaron Cutler. There was a certain broadness to the Rav. This broadness rubbed off on Joe Kamenetsky. And here let me say something else. The Rav's influence went way beyond YU in the Litvish world, in the Torah world, the so-called Orthodox world. You could say the Rav, an Einikol of Reb Chaim, that wasn't enough. You could say the Rav gave Shayurim, but the Shayurim were uptown in the morning, my time, Tuesday and Wednesday mornings. I don't know in the 40s when it was, but my time, Tuesday and Wednesday morning. People worked Tuesday and Wednesday. People were caught up, whatever they were doing, teaching Torah. Everyone works in the morning. But the Rav did something else that greatly exposed him to Lakewood, Chaim Berlin, Teira Vidas, Mir, etc. Occasionally, he gave public lectures. Two times a year, he gave public lectures that became the seminal events of learning and Yiras Shamayim on the Torah scene. One, of course, was the Yahrzeit lecture. The other one was the Tshuva Drasha. These two lectures, the Yahrzeit lecture on the Yahrzeit of Father Gimel Shvat, the Tshuva Drasha, some point between Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, these drushas never changed. They were always in Yiddish. The level of these drushas are indescribable. I'll give you a simple example from my Russian activities. I became very close to Rabbi Eliezer Kugel. Rabbi Eliezer Kugel married to the granddaughter of Rabbi Levine, married to the niece of Rabbi Yashiv. Yomo can tell you a little bit about him. He helped organize Shvut Ami, early 80s, 80, 81. I mean, could you imagine there was a Beis Medrash in the center of the town, which was entirely in Russian, and people were learning Shas like a regular yeshiva. These were all brilliant people who had come out of Russia with PhDs and degrees, but of course they couldn't be mainstreamed. And this yeshiva, Reb Lezer Kugel, was a gone idea. He didn't be well. I believe he's still sharing shurim today. He's probably into his 90s. Yomo can fill you in.
He's learning in
Made a Beis Medrash in his house. His house is right near Machne Yehuda, in the back of Machne Yehuda, as I recall. I've been to his house. And so one time, I gave him cassettes of a Tshuva Drasha of the Rav. And here's a man who grew up. His father-in-law was Rabbi Yehuda Lubavitch. This was the Shemin and Solet of the Jerusalem Torah community. And he listened to these tapes of the Rav. He told me, no one in the world equals what he just heard. He said he couldn't believe the depth, the level, the sources, the Rav, and this ability willy-nilly attracted people way beyond yeshiva, And the Rav, to a certain degree, interacted with this world, and Joe Kamenetsky became very close to the Rav as well. He considered the Rav a second fabulous influence on him. And here I have to tell you, and he describes it, we all thought Mashiach was around the corner. And I'll quote to you the exact talk, actually. And the mid-50s, Chinuch Atzmai was desperate for funds. And here, too, you have to understand the historic fact. Chinuch Atzmai began against the wishes and the will of the government. The government, Ben-Gurion, understood you have to have tuz ramim, two different types of schools, chinuch dati, chinuch mamlachti dati, but it has to be governmental. The religious world, the Aguda world, refused in any way would they want their chinuch to be under the supervision of the Israeli government, of the Mapai, of someone like Ben-Gurion or the people he would pick. So Chinuch Atzmai began on its own. It was not recognized, not supported, and Chinuch Atzmai had to raise funds to support their schools. Now, let me just comment on this. Number one, this is where Reb Aaron Cutler, and this is for you, Noach, was very upset with the Safmurov, because had they voted in the elections, Aguda would have had more representation. The more representation, the more money, the more influence you have. And Reb Aaron was very, very upset with the Safmurov. And any old-time Lakewood student knows this. That's one side story. The other side story, this is the greatness of Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin, unfortunately, was not from. He was an inverted Marano, to quote Rakefet. On the outside, spoke Baruch Hashem, Be'ezrat Hashem. But you judge a person the way he educates his children. His children did not go to Mamlachti Dati schools. And take my word for it, I know what I'm saying. People get very upset with me. No, Menachem Begin, an inverted Marano. It's a lot better than being totally non-frum. Menachem Begin became prime minister. One of the great achievements of the Aguda world, Chinuch Atzmai today, is covered by the state budget 100%. 100, underline that. It went first, it was 50, 70, 80, 100%. Now, Chinuch Atzmai had to raise money in America. By the mid-50s, this was a tremendous crisis. And finally, they came upon an idea of having a dinner where they would honor Reb Aaron Cutler. And who would be the speaker? Reb Yosef Dave Halevi Soloveitchik. I have to tell you, that was one of the most memorable moments ever. And I'm quoting now from the book, A Fire in His Soul by Amos Bunim. I believe I've quoted from the book before. It's by Amos about his father, Irvin Bunim. I'm quoting from page 372. And this is the Rav speaking at the dinner. I'll end off the class. I just want to quote this. And this is the Rav in Yiddish, translated into English. And let me tell you the truth. Reb Aaron Cutler was the first who began laboring for Chinuch Atzmai. Reb Aaron banged on office doors when no one extended any help except for a few Hasidic Rebbeim and a few Gedolim, among them Reb Lezer Silva. But I know that he sacrificed his own yeshiva, because when you approach an individual once for funds, you cannot return. He gave it for this year. Come back next year. But you can't come to him twice. And I know that Rabbarim suffered indignities. I know of specific instances when they refused to welcome him as he sat waiting half an hour, and the owner delivered a message saying he was out. He was persistent, and he lured me in. I have to support him. I have to support Chinuch Atzmai. And in conclusion, I can tell you one thing, and he quotes, "Then did Moses sing this song of praise to Hashem." The entire poem comprises 19-20 verses. The Torah devotes an entire chapter to the Shira. Immediately following the Shira, there are two verses, and Miriam the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took the trimble in her hand, and all the maidens followed her with trimbles and with dances. And Miriam intoned, "Sing to Hashem, for he is exalted. Horse and rider he hurled into the sea," which the Torah brackets in a completely separate chapter. Apparently, the Torah saw fit to draw a parallel between Moses' extended song and Miriam's pithy remarks. Why? Because when Moses sang the song to Hashem, the Ribbono Shel Olam never forgot that but for Miriam's chesed, Israel's Redeemer might never have been born, and once born, would surely have been drowned, to which Amnon and Yochefet did not understand. But this little Miriam felt intuitively. And the Rav goes on to describe Miriam, we all know, her Mesirat Nefesh, the cradle in the water. When the great moment of victory arrived, the Torah never forgot Miriam and accorded her the same portion it accorded Moses. Miriam's terse, laconic words juxtaposed to Moses' 19 verses of praise are equal in importance. And Rabbarim was the Miriam who stood alone at the exception of Chinuch Atzmai while others cried, "Rabbarim, Rabbarim, where is your prophecy, your hopes, where is your optimism and your faith? No one will listen to you." It's like they said to Miriam, "When we sing our song of praise, we accord him the greatest measure, Oz Yashir." And this is the way the Rav praised Rav Aaron with his full heart, his full soul. Earlier in the talk, the Rav said, and this is famous, and you can actually, I think there's a recording of it where you actually hear it happening, where the Rav said, "When I see Rav Aaron, I'm reminded of my grandfather, Rav Chaim." And the Rav went on to praise Rav Aaron in learning, and Rav Aaron started to cry, "Nishtemis, nishtemis, I'm not on that level, not on that level, not true, not true." But you see, this had a great impact on Joe Kamenetsky. We're not narrow. And we don't have to react. You see, the right-wing world dismisses us. I told you, Eli Schlossberg just sent me another long letter of his discussions with Rabbi Feldman, and he's going to have a meeting with Rabbi Alspand of Lakewood, Tells, Riverdale. Very important. Tells today, Chicago and Riverdale are the most important branches. But they dismiss us. They can't. What did Rabbi Wasserman and Rabbi Kagan say to the people in Denver 41 years ago? "We can't invite Harav Rakefet to give his shiur to speak in the yeshiva. We can't allow our students to see," pardon me for quoting this, "a Talmud Chacham of such stature who wears a kippah sruga." And you see, but we react differently. We can be big. We can be open. We can be optimistic. We can be generous of spirit. And this was the Rav, and it gave a lot of insight and a lot of understanding to Dr. Joe. And Dr. Joe says, "What I love about the Rav is his whole being is devoted to education, and this is what Torah Mesorah is about. And I need not tell you, the Rav Maimonides, the classroom in yeshiva, his whole being, the public lectures, his whole being, what the Rav used to say, my maddening commitment to the study and teaching of Torah. And this had great impact. One other historic fact that's in this chapter on the Rav, Dr. Belkin, when Azrieli was organized and YU was getting involved in teachings, people how to teach, how to convey Torah, even before Azrieli, they had postgraduate school programs. So Dr. Belkin wanted to bring Joe Kamenetsky full-time to run this program, put the syllabus together, bring in the teachers, put it on the map. And the Rav said to him, leave him alone. Shmuel, leave Dr. Kamenetsky where he is. He's doing fabulous work. And you can understand already why Reb Moshe Feinstein stood up for Dr. Joe. All right, we're not finished with Dr. Joe. We have more to go, but I hope we did a little credit to understanding his mindset, understanding the influences on him. And that's that story of Reb Yitzchak Isaac Scher and America and Slabodka. That story repeats itself time and time again. You cannot imagine the influence these Rashi Yeshiva had raising funds in America, but willy-nilly, Baal Kacham, their very presence attracted American youngsters. Libam Chashka B'Torah, their heart wanted Torah. And here you have the Kletzka Rashi Yeshiva in America. Here you have the Slabodka Rashi Yeshiva, later Mashkiach, in America. Here you have, could you imagine Reb Baruch Ber Leibovich, the Kamenetzka Rashi Yeshiva in America? They say he barely raised funds. He was so busy teaching and lecturing and giving shmusin in America, they had to remind him that you're here to raise funds, not to teach. But you can just multiply this and multiply this. And a lot of our memoir literature on what Europe was about was a result of these Americans who wound up in Europe, wound up in the yeshivat. And many of them later wrote about it, spoke about it. We have a world of information from the American emigres who ultimately came back to America. Afterwards, they had to run away from Hitler, if you recall, when I spoke about the Torah Vadas Rosh Yeshiva, who am I referring to? Yeah, Rabbi Isbi's brother-in-law, Rabbi Scher. Rabbi Shor. He had to run back to America. He was in Kletsk. I mean, it's just beyond words what Hitler did. But thank God, miraculously, there's continuity. There's continuity. Okay, so to reiterate, Baruch Hashem, what did we do today? We continued with the life of Rabbi Kamenetsky. We continued with the influences on him, and I think we portrayed correctly how this man, a total YU product with all that that implies, was able to build Torah Mesorah and have amicable relations with all the Rashi Yeshiva and all that happened in America following World War II. We still have two topics that we want to cover with Dr. Joe Kamenetsky. We want to cover the office, the staff, some of the people he brought in. We want to cover his relationship with the Rabbinic Advisory Board, which we've alluded to. We're going to detail in his own words. And then we want to deal with the Kamenetskys, the relationship between Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and Joe. And finally, I'll end off with a description right out of our lives today in 2022, published just a few days ago. Unbelievable. Brings it all home. The Sunday class, we pick up where we left off, and Jack, you're still fighting a battle on the Divrei Torah, Reb Menashe Klein, that it's Purim Torah, and you're worried, you're questioning whether he knew about the influence of the non-Jewish world on the Jewish world, and the costumes and Purim, and the Mardi Gras, and what goes on in Venice. Until today, outside of Corona, I wouldn't go near Venice today. But the answer is no, he wasn't a historian, and he could come up with what he came up with. It's a shtickel teira. I'm positive he didn't know the historic process. You find that all the time. There in Talmud Chachamim, Rabbi Schechter, Rabbi Heschel got involved in tremendous machloikis because he wrote something which was historically incorrect. And I told my Talmidim at the time that no one says Reb Heschel is a Jewish historian. He's a Gaon Adir. But history is a different study. Not always do we combine the two. So I still, it could be you're right, it could be Purim Torah. But what about the Torah I quoted yesterday? It's also, you can ask 1,000 questions on it. But homiletically, that's the way his mind worked. As a matter of fact, next week, Sunday, you'll see a Shaila that he asks, and how he begins, whatever hair you have left will stand on edge. That's all. I don't have any hair left, so my hair can't stand on edge. But all my younger Talmidim, your hair will stand on edge when you see the way he begins the Shaila. And could you picture me asking that Shaila of the Rav, let's say? Wow, wow, wow. I don't know. With all due respect to Joe Kamenetsky, the Rav had his limits too. Okay, are there any questions in the classroom in front of me? Any questions? Yomo, you went... don't wake him up. Let him sleep. And let me just say to the classroom here until we meet again, in health and happiness, das vedanya. Morty, can you open it up? Any comments from across the world? It's open. We got to work quickly because
a class is coming. Reb Moshe got up for everybody.
Reb Moshe got up for everybody? I don't know, Reb.
And by the way, Henny Machlis'
recording
brother,
has stopped.
Yeah.
Henny
yeah.
Machlis' brother and sister-in-law are in the process of making Aliyah from Flatbush.
I know a lot of people.
So they're out.
Yeah, I know a lot of people from Flatbush that are making Aliyah from this semi-right-wing world, which really reflects on how bad the matzav is in America. In other words, it's Avat Mordechai and Sinat Haman. I came in Aliyah, Avat Mordechai, totally. But today it's half and half. But that's good. Baruch Hashem, I wrote to someone in America, the only good news out of America is that it's encouraging Aliyah today. Baruch Hashem, halavai.
I heard someone speak about the Tika b'Shofar Gadol. The Inyan of Shofar Gadol is that you go for positive reasons.
Well, Tolichenu... Tolichenu kama miyut le'atzenu. But let me tell you, Steve, you have to send me the time. I have the address and everything else. I just need the time for Wednesday.
By the way, what did the Kohen Gadol say Tolichenu kama miyut le'atzenu in Bayit Rishon? Bayit Sheni, I can understand. Are we assuming that that was done in Bayit Rishon?
It could be a PRP nevuah that he knew times would come where we need the Tolichenu kama miyut. But I just want to tell you, even if they come for not entirely positive reasons, let them come, because I've seen more than once families come here to experiment, to come for a year, and I see the children don't let the parents go back. And I've seen that many, many times. So let them come, let them come. We need Jews here desperately. The more Jews, the better. The more Jews, the more sanctity. The more Jews, the more Torah. There's Rat Hashem, the Kavod Ul Tiferet.
I sent you the Hekster Shiva information.
Yeah, I need the email address, so it'll be sent to me.
I sent you his brother's cell phone.
Yeah, but when you get me involved with cell phones, it means time and trying to figure out hours and hoping they'll answer and hoping they'll be in. An email I can send out. And
right.
It'll
if you get the email, you can forward it.
If
I don't have the email, but I have the brothers. I know the brother because I know their third cousin.
No, the brother is well known.
She didn't know about it. She's in California, so I texted her during the shiur yesterday, but it was earlier there, and she called her aunt and got the information and sent it to me.
Very nice. But
I used to work with his what, with Rev Naftali's, Rev Herbie's wife's father, when I was laning in my teens in Sheepshead Bay. He was essentially the mashgiach there.
Of what?
The mashgiach there.
Of what? What do you mean in Sheepshead Bay? What were they manufacturing?
There was a home for adults.
Ah.
So he was basically the Rav Amashia.
Aha. Ivanti.
This was Rev Weinberger Sr.
Aha. All I know is that
Kew Gardens.
A lot of my students know the family from Washington Heights. And it's Baruch Hashem, a wonderful family, the Kabbat al-Tiferet. And Charlie Hex, there's a story. Here's a kid who went to MTA, went to Kol Torah Yeshiva, his Yeti roots, and then winds up in Harvard, then winds up in Israel. And he told me when he came to Israel, he was coming on postdoctoral research, and they wanted him to do research, and they said, there's only one person in the world working in this field. We'll arrange for you to work with him. It was Dr. Ephraim Katsir. And he was later killed. He was president. It was his brother was killed. He was also a scientist, killed by that Japanese attack in Lud Airport in the 70s. And Charlie told me he didn't come here a Zionist. He was raised in Kilat HaDat Yeshur. And when he worked with Dr. Katsir, he could never, ever go back to America. He became a full-fledged Tzioni Dati. And we owe that to Dr. Katsir. The Katsir brothers were raised in Gula. They came from a frum background, but like everyone else, only a very small part of that background remained. And the Nebuch, his brother, was a korban. I'll never forget that. The mayor, I think, was prime minister at the time. Check it out. It might even be the early 70s. A lot of people were killed. This Japanese moron started shooting indiscriminately after he got off the plane at Lud Airport. What we have gone through and going through, the Ribbono Shel Olam should give strength. Okay, anyone else? Okay, I want to...
Just one thing. The book, I mean, it's a minor point, but the book from Dr. Kamenetsky, it's published by Shah Press.
Shah Press.
I think Art Scroll, it seems pretty obvious, Art Scroll set up this imprint.
Right.
Shah is whatever deals with the 20th century, because I get the feeling Art Scroll doesn't want to have to mention things like YU, Soloveitchik, things like that. So whenever it's a book like Rabbi Wein's books, you even see there's a break. It's like everything, the same series, everything before 1900 is Art Scroll, and everything afterward, it's not really us. You know, it's still censored by them and everything, but, we don't want to have to go there.
It could be. They also have what's called Misora Press. I think that also...
Yeah, I think Misora is part of Art Scroll. Art Scroll is part of Misora.
Right.
It's almost all of Misora.
Listen,
the Rav's Machzorim were also Art Scroll, but they were like a different name. They have like 5-6 different names, something like
right,
that.
All right, they're very smart.
Kanain
Hara, money.
Page A, Prefuel Shlom
Amzina. Yeah, no, I know, they put that in.
It wasn't the page for that. They used the regular page and put page A or B after that, something like that.
I wanted to say about this memorable encounters of Art Scroll censorship. I was told shortly after the book came out that the cover picture of Rabbi Kamenetsky was doctored, because in that picture he was wearing a bow tie, like he usually did, and was seen as too risque, so they put a regular tie on it.
Got it. Okay. If that's true, they did a good job putting the tie on, because it looks real, color kavod. But that's why you can't depend upon any pictures today as testimony or truth, because they can doctor it. What people, I know we had a big party in my family. It was an 80th birthday, and one person could not make it. And in the picture I have, there he is. He's right there in the picture. You would never in a million years wouldn't think he wasn't there. But this is what they can do today. Baruch Hashem. But to take out a bow tie, oh my. But they did a good job, I have to say. I would never in a million years think that isn't real. Even with how it fits in with the shirt, fabulous. All right, I want to thank everyone for their kind participation, and we should just have Besora Tova, Yeshuot V'Nechamot, Oleinu V'al Kol Yisrael, and until we meet again in health and happiness. And Mark Weiner, you should be successful in your efforts. Sherry told me all about your phone call. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'Danya.